Chapter 3, Post Tenebras Lux. The alarm in Mark's head went off precisely at 7 a.m., literally the alarm in his head. It was Mark's last thought to set it before he drifted off into a dreamless yet rather troubled sleep. Anything your cell could do, a nascent capable person could do mentally with an in-body sensory display system that projected it as seeing or hearing in your brain, just as you would on your physical smart device. Actually, mental pictures, and their corresponding sounds, are clearer and more dynamic. No density of pixels can compare to pure sensory perception, projected on the mind, in thought. A level 2 capable person could check email, calendar, texts, social media, all apps, etc., across all platforms, either through the tower of your regular cell provider via shared connectivity to AlphaSat, or directly through the global Wi-Fi, available now for nascent users, so linked to its orbital singularity servers, and perceive it all, device-free, purely in your mind. Mark stubbed his toe against the door jamb on the way to the bathroom, just off the kitchen. He winced in the unique jolt of that joy. When he opened his eyes, he paused with a strange feeling that something wasn't right. He scanned the kitchen and determined that everything was fine. Then he took one step and paused again. Wait, he thought to himself. The kitty litter. The book. Where is it? The broken, latched, spring-activated lid was up with no sign of the glorified paperweight to hold it down. This caught his eye because that was the first sight that greeted him when he left his darkened bedroom to pay his morning homage to the bathroom. Like a faithful sentinel, a nightlight positioned right above the cat box supplies tried, in vain, to remind him daily to buy a new dispenser. Nah, Megan. Mark resisted the urge that had set him towards the bathroom as he changed his path towards the living room, now tiptoeing across the kitchen floor with an eerie shiver up his spine. The light from the living room was on. Stranger yet, since he had not entered the living room when he arrived home the night before. He stealthily craned his neck around the corner and, as his eyes adjusted to the light, he saw Max seated on the couch, with the missing Bible opened on his lap. Bro, your cat is dead. Max whispered shallowly, never lifting his eyes to look at his brother. Huh? Mark mouthed as his eyes shifted to Barfield's stiffened corpse lying in a shadowy corner of the living room. Dumbfoundedly, Mark continued, I don't, what? Max, what is going on? The macabre circumstances notwithstanding, for Mark to see Max sitting on his couch in his apartment would have elicited the same dumb response in that Max had never visited Mark at any of his places. And now to see Max sitting there on his couch, the avowed intellectual atheist, reading the Bible nonetheless? It all had about the same force of fancy on his psyche that seeing a leprechaun riding a unicorn would have had. Mark was truly the middle child, not just in terms of birth order, but being so positioned between his siblings and their respective extremes of temper, demeanor, and direction in life. Two people could not have been so different, coming from the same mother as Max and Megan. Megan's bleeding heart was the polar opposite of Max's hard, cold, and calculating heart. Megan was the consummate glass-half-full gal. Max's glass was bone-dry. Meg was a spontaneous creature of the moment. Max was as spontaneous as glacial creep. Max was an unbeliever, a naturalistic empiricist who saw life as a cosmological equation to be solved. Megan was a believer. She exuded a transcendent reality beyond the senses. Mark had a unique room with a view through which to see how an immoral, atheistic, humanistic worldview coalesced in the pride of a supreme intellect in Max, compared and contrasted with a traditionally moral, theistic, Judeo-Christian worldview coalesced in the humility of a pure faith in Meg. Their parents had often tried to narrow the gap between the two, with Mark being emotionally squeezed between them. It did not help that Max was born 10 years before Mark, thus putting a full dozen years between himself and Megan. Their father tried to find ways to build sibling bonds between the three. He'd often refer to the family as 3M and Company. But that type of thing was always uncomfortable and forced. Such bonding attempts always made everyone feel awkward, putting a magnifying glass on the obvious disconnects between the siblings. David Manstead had married his college sweetheart, Margaret Jovanovich, during the winter break between their mutual sophomore and junior years at Stanford University. Dave married Maggie for two reasons. One, they loved each other wildly. Two, they loved each other wildly. And that brought Maximilian Gabriel Manstead into their lives that next spring. They were wide-eyed lovers, happy to be together and ready for anything. One thing they had agreed upon was no more kids until after they both had successfully completed grad school. Later, they added inclusion of earning both their PhDs to that post-nuptial agreement. Almost exactly 10 years after Max had blazed the trail, Mark was born. Dave and Maggie were joined at the heart and at the head. Both were Mensa chapter members at Stanford. They had tested out with the exact IQ score. In fact, they were initially scrutinized and almost denied entry into the club for suspected cheating, because not only were their scores the same, but they had answered every test question exactly the same. Fast forward from Max's birth 15 years to his entry into the same club. Max had shown signs of being intellectually gifted early on. He was speaking in full sentences at 1 year old and was toddler debating with his father and mother by the time he was two. Sometimes it was difficult to determine who the toddler was. The Mansteads had Max assessed at age 14 in order to get him an early start on college entrance preps. Stunningly, Max not only met the qualifications for Mensa, but he had scored significantly beyond his parents' giftedness and was given an invitation to become a recognized member of the 999 Society. The TNS boasted an exclusive roll of only 1,900 members worldwide, comprised entirely of those who were established to have an IQ above 99.9% of the global population. The TNS functioned as an informal virtual gathering place for the world's greatest intellects to share what was on their minds. Every member was treated to a copy of TNS's bi-monthly magazine, Vidya. Vidya is an ancient Sanskrit word meaning science, learning, knowledge, scholarship. Any and all knowledge, whether true or false. Max was in. At the age of 17, by special invitation of the board of the Society, Max attended Camp Brainiac, a summer-long boot camp for those with special intellectual abilities. The camp, though hosted by the TNS, was sponsored and underwritten by a few of the world's industry leaders in information technologies, medical research, and engineering, along with some very prestigious colleges and universities. The Mansteads had hoped the experience would open their son up emotionally and relationally. They were disappointed, though, when Max returned home more withdrawn and serious. Margaret thought, darker? For all his intellectual abilities, Max had serious relational deficiencies. Truth be told, Max had never bonded emotionally with either his mother or his father. Maggie cried many times while sharing her burdened mother's heart with Dave. Max barely tolerates me. I am a necessary figure in his life, but not his mum. Even when I hug him, I feel like he's just looking over my shoulder waiting for it to be over. Dave would often console his wife, but he privately shared her pain and sadness. Dave was from a close-knit Midwestern family that shared every experience together. Maggie was the grandchild of Serbian immigrants. The words, the old country, and porodica, Serbian for family, were used every day in the tight and loving bond of her three-generational upbringing. In her earliest years, they all lived together under the same roof, in a house just off the central city of Chicago. Her great-grandfather was a well-known priest in the old country who had amazingly moved all 16 of his family members from Bosnia to the US during the years between World War I and World War II. There was some ambiguity in the way they referred to him as great-grandfather, and there were conflicting stories in that regard, mostly because of the upheaval of the circumstances that existed in the Balkans just prior to World War I. After securing safe passage for the family, Papa stayed behind and was never heard from again. It was thought that he did not survive the war. The emotional detachment between Max and his parents was huge, a departure from his heritage on both sides of the family, and it had a very chilling effect on the entire familial environment of the Manstead home. Max never played a game with either sibling. He never attended an event or a party with Mark. Max rarely even acknowledged Mark. Mark had always felt invisible in Max's presence, and a silent animosity had eventually filled Mark's heart against his brother. Megan did have a relationship of sorts with Max. One day, when Max was about 25, he came by the house to pick something up from the storage shed out back. Max was waiting in the family room for his father to find the key to the shed. Mark just happened to be walking down the hallway at the right moment to witness an astonishingly unfamiliar sight and sound. Max was laughing. Megan was performing a ballet sequence she had been learning for her teen dance recital. She was purposely schmaltzing it up by tripping all over herself. She concluded the performance by dramatically face-planting on the carpet in front of her otherwise always stoic eldest brother. And then it happened. Max laughed. Who knew that this TNS, emotionally paralyzed intellectual phenom, was very, very deep down, a connoisseur of mindless slapstick? When Megan gathered herself up from the tangle of knees and elbows on the floor, she leaned over and whispered something in Max's ear. Mark would always remember the look on Max's face as Meg twirled away for a second act. Max was in a strange, new, and evidently pleasant place, in his soul. Whatever Meg had whispered seemed to fill Max's face with a light that Mark hadn't seen before, or since. Mark shifted his eyes slowly from the cat's lifeless form back to Max. There was no light in Max's face now. He just sat there, crazily transfixed in some tortured thought. So dark. Mark's stomach sickened as he focused closer on Max's eyes. He thought at that moment Max looked more truly dead than the cat did. Max, I asked you, what is going on? Where's Megan? I don't know. Why? Max, you look like hell, like literal hell. Mark said as he sensed an electrical arch of terror suddenly flash into the room. Shut up! Screamed Max as he began to growl and bark in an animalistic-sounding torrent of profanity-laced gibberish, unlike anything Mark had ever heard. It seemed to Mark that this was a kind of purging, a psychological fit of emotional vomiting. Mark went lightheaded and he felt his own puke surging up into his throat. As he choked it back down, Mark shouted over the top of Max's now psychotic rant, Max! It's okay, calm down, it's going to be all right! Mark felt like he was trying to wake Max up from a nightmare. The look in Max's eyes was raw horror. As a hunter, Mark had seen that look in the eye of an occasional and unfortunate prey that needed finishing off after an errant kill shot. Just as the knife cuts away the last moment of that helpless, wounded creature's life, there's a look. Max had that look. Mark feared that Max's head might explode. The veins on his forehead bulged, and his skin turned from red to purple to almost black. The utterances coming from Max's mouth were beyond visceral and vile. It was as if he had been gripped internally by some inconsolable, primal fear. Max was in the throes of a fevered seizure of horror emanating from a place within him deeper than his mind. This was spiritual, like a botched exorcism that only stirs the coals of hell rather than extinguishing them. Mark reached down to steady his brother, but Max yelled, "Don't!" With that, Max went silent and his head slammed back and still against the back of the couch. Was he dead? Mark couldn't breathe. Max's eyes opened wide, looking straight up to the ceiling, or beyond, perhaps, he calmly asked, again, "Where is Megan?" Mark sensed not to answer that directly. As a diversion, he replied, "Megan gave me that Bible." Max closed the book on his lap and slid it down beside his thigh. He closed his eyes again and began to speak in a measured, sharp tone. "I hated mother and father for getting religion. I felt betrayed. How could they? How embarrassing for them. Humiliating for me." Max paused and pulled on the collar of his sweaty, half-unbuttoned, disheveled dress shirt. "I saw through you, though. I remember when you and Meg were baptized in that pond behind the church. How old were you?"
15.
Mark trailed off ashamedly. "I saw you come up from the water and I knew you thought it was a bunch of crap. But Meg... Well, for me... Stop. Please don't talk. Listen. In Meg. Well, there was something there that hit me hard. Until yesterday, I had supposed it was just a stress-induced religious suggestion, a mental illusion of that moment. After all, I was losing my family to some Kool-Aid drinking insanity. So, just for that instant, as Meg came up out of the water, I saw a light on her. Maybe in her, maybe through her? I shook it off as I realized my susceptibility to the suggestion. But something she said to me a few days later, back at the house, in a whisper. As she spoke, it flashed in my mind. That same light, I mean. Mark, I had a religious experience. It lasted the rest of that day, and I wrestled with it into the night. I had an indescribable pleasure. It was joy or peace, both. At the same time, I had a comfortable doubt speaking to me. Comfortable in the sense of an old trusted friend talking you out of making a bad decision. By the next morning, I had pushed the light. The whole thing, out of my mind, and I got on with my life. For Max, getting on with his life at that point meant taking his first postdoctoral position as an adjunct professor in the physics department at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He was sponsored for the non-tenured position in association with GE Healthcare, the US-based multinational conglomerate. Max did his internship with GE at his father's suggestion. Dave had been working at the time as an employee of GE Medical in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, when the internship opened up. By this time in the conversation, both Mark and Max needed a break. So after an unusually long silence, Mark continued, "What did Meg say?" No response. "Max, what did Meg whisper to you?" Max opened his eyes, turned his head toward Mark, and with a transcendent peacefulness said, "Post tenebris lux." As their eyes met, Mark shuddered. Max's eyes were bloodshot and sunken back grotesquely into their sockets, rimmed with what looked like bruises or scrapes, burns maybe. "What, Latin?" stammered Mark. "What does it mean? After darkness, light. After darkness, light." Max squinted as if trying to focus on something floating between him and Mark. "I don't understand. I believe." Max closed his eyes tight, took a deep breath. Exhaled, another lengthy pause set in. "The light, it must be real." Max seemed utterly transported back to that place in his mind when he had his religious experience at Megan's whisper. That same peace must have washed over him again in that moment, because the expression of horror twisted on his face just a few minutes ago had completely vanished. The change was as stark as dark giving way to light. "You mean you believe because you saw some kind of light through Meg, like 10 years ago?" Max opened his eyes, now brimming with tears. "No, I believe there is such a light because I saw the darkness, in it, in him, them, yesterday, post tenebris lux." He repeated it into silence. "Mark." He trembled as the darkness rushed back into his expression. Where is Megan?" To Mark, it seemed that whatever Max had seen or experienced yesterday had torn down, broken, or otherwise altered the presuppositional background of his psyche. He was a different person. He looked like a little boy sitting there, fidgety, unsure, afraid, and fundamentally psychologically altered, somehow damaged, somehow fixed, like an awakened creature just emerging from a chrysalis. Megan is on her way to Europe. I think she leaves this afternoon from O'Hare. She texted me goodbye late last night before I went to bed. Some sort of a college missions trip or humanitarian aid outreach, with a group she belongs to at Trinity. Mom was telling me something about it last week on the phone, but I didn't catch all the details. Bosnia. Yeah, that's right. You talked to Mom? My God, no! Meg! Max clenched his teeth in a volcanic rush of panic mixed with anger. He jumped to his feet, and the Bible launched across the room into the shadows next to the cat. With an intense, hyperventilated whisper, like hot steam under high pressure, Max gazed past Mark into some other place in his mind and hissed, "Get your goddamned black hand off my sister!" Without another word, Max pushed Mark out of the way. He stormed to the door and threw it open, charging out into the hallway, repeating loudly until the elevator door silenced him, "God no, God no, God no!"